Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice. Today, we open our show with some information about how you can get free COVID tests from the federal government through the U.S. Postal Service and a warning from the district attorney in San Diego about fake COVID tests. Sheriff Gore has announced he'll be retiring on February 3rd. Who's running to fill his seat? We'll have information on all four candidates on today's show. Next up, on our local government report, we'll have information on actions taken this week by the La Mesa City Council and the El Cajon City Council, as well as a controversy brewing from several council members who defied the state's mask-wearing mandate amid the Omicron surge of COVID-19. We'll tell you about a hearing coming up on exempting homeless shelters from county zoning requirements. And then we'll have information on how you can get relief if you're behind on your mortgage payments due to COVID-19 through a new state-run program. Lemon Grove is going to be having a special photography exhibit for Black History Month, and we'll have details on today's show. From California News Service, hear about education funds in the governor's proposed budget that are the highest ever proposed. If you've lost a loved one to COVID, learn how you can get reimbursed for funeral expenses from the federal government on today's show. California is getting low ratings for child welfare, and we'll have details from California News Service. We'll have some national news headlines, including the latest on the voting rights efforts in Congress, from Public News Service. And back to local news, we'll have highlights of some local events coming up at county libraries across East County. Hear about a college aid program for refugees. And we'll also have a couple of our Best of East County episodes today that we hope you'll enjoy, including the infamous jailbreak from El Cajon's far from secure former jail, as told by one of the rescuers of a prisoner who got in trouble. And on Ready, Set, Grow, Master Gardener Connie Beck will share tips on how to attract butterflies and hummingbirds to your home garden. So stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters.
This is Marie Johnson with a health report. Every household in America can now receive 4 free COVID-19 tests from the federal government. The U.S. Postal Service began accepting online orders starting January 18th at special.usps.com/testkits. The rapid antigen COVID-19 test will be shipped free by the U.S. Postal Service starting in late January. There is a limit of 4 tests per household, no matter how many people are in your household. If you need testing sooner due to exposure or symptoms, or if you need additional testing in San Diego County, you can visit sandiegocounty.gov and click on the COVID link. The site also has information on when to get tested, reliability of tests, and more. All COVID-19 testing in California is free. If you don't want to go out to get tested, you can also now purchase self-tests to give at home. These are available in stores, pharmacies, and online, but make sure to visit the Food and Drug Administration website for a list of authorized tests to avoid scams. Just put COVID tests into the search bar at fda.gov to find this information.
San Diego County District Attorney Summer Steffen is warning consumers to steer clear of unapproved at-home COVID-19 tests as people become increasingly desperate to get tested for the Omicron variant of coronavirus. Consumers should only buy tests approved by the U.S. Food and Drug Association, or FDA. Scammers are always waiting for their next opportunity to take advantage of unsuspecting consumers, and the shortage of COVID-19 tests is no different. The Federal Trade Commission has issued a list of tips on how to vet at-home tests. Only by tests authorized by the FDA, which you can find at fda.gov. Check out a seller before you buy, especially if you're not familiar with the site. Search online for the website, company, seller's name, and words like scam, complaint, or review. When buying online, pay by credit card. If you're charged for something you don't get, or for a product that's not as advertised, you can dispute that charge with your credit card company. Now, if you have been scammed, report it to the Federal Trade Commission at reportfraud.ftc.gov. You can also contact the San Diego DA's Consumer Protection Team at consumer@sdcda.org. If you're looking for an in-person test site, you can find a list of free COVID testing sites through sandiegocounty.gov. And as we reported earlier in the show, you can also order 4 free tests through the U.S. Postal Service. A new law that the San Diego District Attorney's Office co-sponsored expands the price gouging laws that are in effect until the end of April to include online purchases as well as in-person ones. To report an incident of price gouging or a fake or suspicious testing site, you can call the San Diego District Attorney's Consumer Hotline at 619-531-3507 or email consumer@sdcda.org. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
Sheriff Bill Gore has announced that he will retire effective February 3rd after 51 years in law enforcement, nearly a year before his term of office would have ended. He was appointed sheriff in 2009 to fill a vacancy left by the retirement of Bill Colander, later winning elections 3 times. Gore's retirement opens the door for a new sheriff for the first time in 12 years. 4 candidates have announced plans to run, including Undersheriff Kelly Martinez, who Gore has endorsed. Other candidates are retired Sheriff's Commander Dave Myers, Sheriff Deputy Kenneth Newsom, and Assistant Attorney John Hemmerling. Undersheriff Martinez will become acting sheriff upon Gore's retirement. County supervisors will convene in March to consider appointment an interim sheriff, according to Nathan Fletcher, chairman of the Board of Supervisors. But Fletcher says it would be, quote, inappropriate for us to put our thumb on the scale this close to the election by appointing a person who is a candidate for sheriff. Martinez issued a statement indicating she would not accept an appointment as interim sheriff if offered, stating, "The people of San Diego deserve a fair race for sheriff, as well as an appointment process they can trust." The county will announce a public process for people to apply to serve as interim sheriff, vet the applicants, and allow full public input. Fletcher indicated the interim sheriff should aim to reduce violent crime, supporting improving jail conditions, embrace best practices to lead a law enforcement agency, and have a commitment to racial justice. Supervisor Joel Anderson, who represents East County community, says Gore has many things to be proud of, including lowering the recidivism rate in county jails and improving the concealed weapons license process. Under Sheriff Gore's leadership, this year, the Sheriff's Department successfully shut down all known illegal drug storefronts in the unincorporated communities, Anderson adds. Sheriff Gore began his law enforcement career in 1970 with the FBI. He rose to the rank of Assistant Director in Washington, D.C., and also served as Special Agent in charge of the FBI field offices in San Diego and Seattle. He later worked as Chief Investigator and Special Advisor to San Diego County District Attorney Bonnie Dumanis. In 2004, then-Sheriff Bill Colander appointed Gore as the Assistant Sheriff overseeing the Law Enforcement Services Bureau. He later became Undersheriff before becoming Sheriff. Gore says serving as sheriff has been one of the most rewarding experiences of his law enforcement career. He praised those in his department and said that he looks forward to giving his full attention and support now to his wife, quote, as she has done for me during our 43 years of marriage. A statement from the Sheriff's Department reads, Sheriff Gore has dedicated his life to public safety in San Diego and nationally. Few individuals have devoted more time, energy, and service to others, adding, he will be greatly missed. Here is some information on the 4 candidates who have announced plans to run for sheriff. Dave Myers has worked in law enforcement for 35 years. At the Sheriff's Department, he worked in many positions before being named commander, overseeing 24 patrol stations and substations. He's managed the Special Investigations Division, including homicide, narcotics, terrorism, and gangs. He received a Medal of Merit from the National Association for work along the border. His website states, I am running for sheriff to change the culture of law enforcement to one that respects people of all genders, sexual orientations, identities, races, ethnicities, and socioeconomic statuses. I promise that my campaign will be one of inclusion. I am the only candidate with the most experience with the sheriff's department and the only one that stood up in the trenches to fix the many problems. I'm clearly the best choice for the job. It's time for a new sheriff in town. Myers, who previously ran for the office, has been openly critical of Gore on issues including the county's high rate of jail deaths, racial profiling, evictions during COVID, and more. His endorsements include several Democratic clubs. Kelly Martinez has worked as a deputy sergeant and captain assigned to the Alpine Rural Command and then as a special assistant tribal liaison. She's also been a commander before her appointment as undersheriff running day-to-day operations at the sheriff's department. In a statement, she says, "I'll work hard to earn the support of San Diego County voters who want a sheriff with experience and commitment to public safety." She has also partnered with the county on non-law enforcement responses to non-crisis situations and help the homeless. She wants to invest in jails, improve transparency to the public, shut down illegal marijuana dispensaries, and have a better monitoring of sexual predators, among other priorities. A former Republican who recently became a Democrat, Martinez's endorsements include Sheriff Bill Gore, the San Diego Deputy Sheriff's Association, and Nathan Fletcher, chairman of the Board of Supervisors, according to her website. John Hemmerling is an Iraq War veteran who has served as a Marine Corps colonel, San Diego police officer, legal counsel for San Diego's chief of police, and head prosecutor in the San Diego City Attorney's Office. According to his website, he has zero tolerance for behavior that violates the values of our sheriff's department. He believes in compassion, fairness, and diversity that reflects our community. His site states, adding that Hemmerling will work hard to stem violence and help victims of crime, as well as rebuild morale and rewarding the efforts of those who work hard to keep our communities safe. His site does not list any endorsements. Kenneth Newsom served with Oceanside Police and in the Marine Corps before spending 20 years in patrol or traffic. He does not have a website or list endorsements. He told the San Diego Deputy Sheriff's Association, Newsom, that he would pledge to visit each sheriff's patrol station, courthouse, and detention facility to speak with deputies and get their input, adding that the department needs a sheriff who has worked in the trenches and has experience beyond a desk. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Mitchell Murphy.
This is Miriam Raftery with a local government report. At the La Mesa City Council's first meeting of the year, Mayor Mark Arapostathis opened with his State of the City speech, calling the city strong. He thanked residents for helping reduce spread of the COVID-19 virus, noting that La Mesa has roughly a 67% vaccination rate. He stated that the city's mortgage assistance program has helped many residents with past due mortgage payments and said the program will soon be expanded to include rental assistance. He praised the city's Homeless Outreach and Mobile Engagement, or HOME team, for helping nearly 60 people find housing. The city has also moved forward to approve new rental housing developments, he said. In the past year, the city also approved the new Arts and Culture Commission to foster diversity through the arts, added a new Community Police Oversight Board, and began providing clean, renewable energy to businesses as a founding member of San Diego Community Power, which will roll out this year to residents. During the meeting, the council also unanimously approved shifting animal services to the San Diego Humane Society. In addition, council voted to replace Vice Mayor Jack Hsu as the city's representative on SANDAG. That's after several residents objected to Hsu voting in support of the mileage tax that many residents opposed. The council majority voted 3-2 to assign Councilman Bill Baber to SANDAG, with Hsu and Councilman Colin Parent voting no. The council voted to extend virtual meetings due to the Omicron variant of COVID. During the meeting, while the audience was virtual, council members and staff did meet in person in council chambers. Newly elected council member Laura Lothian defied the state's indoor mask mandate and refused to wear a mask. She also argued in favor of returning to in-person meetings, as other East County cities have already done. Vice Mayor Hsu objected to Lothian breaking public health rules, and Mayor Arapostathis stated, "We have an obligation to reasonably make sure that our city staff is safe from any risk, but no effort was made to remove Lothian from the meeting or enforce the rule." The council will reconsider whether to return to in-person meetings in February and also announced that virtual participation by the public will be allowed even after in-person council hearings return. La Mesa wasn't the only city dealing with mask mandate scofflaws. At the January 11th El Cajon City Council meeting, Mayor Bill Wells, as well as council members Michelle Mitchell and Phil Ortiz, did not wear masks, despite the city manager's written directive asking everybody in council chambers to comply with the state's indoor mask mandate. All others in attendance, including staff, elected officials, police officers, and members of the public in the audience, obeyed the mandate and wore masks during the meeting. The statewide mandate was issued due to the rapid rise in COVID-19 cases driven by the fast-spreading Omicron variant. During the last week in December and first week of January, the statewide seven-day average case rate increased by more than sixfold as hospitalizations across the state doubled, the California Health Department said. The only public speaker, Suzanne Hansen, urged the council to follow the mask mandate. She said she's a molecular geneticist, then stated, "We have a highly transmissible variant, Omicron, that produces a less lethal disease. But what you need to understand is that more people that are infected, regardless of asymptomatic or mildly ill, the more likely a variant will evolve that is both transmissible and deadly," she warned. She added, "It has been demonstrated over and over again that masks stop the form of transmission and the formation of new, more lethal variants." She also implored members to follow their faith and protect others by wearing masks. The council agenda itself included a report on a proposed new veterans memorial at one of two proposed locations. The next steps will be getting design quotes as well as engaging the community and veterans groups. Council heard a staff report on how $30 million of expenditures through the American Rescue Plan Act have been spent. Some was invested in Foodie Fest, an event to help local restaurants. It ran over budget, so some changes may be considered if the city holds this event in the future. $100,000 was allocated to mitigate vaccine barriers, but only a little over $10,000 was actually spent by the program's end, leaving $90,000 that can be reallocated. A hefty portion of federal funds were expended through the Small Business Grant Program. Since the end of September, 25 El Cajon businesses applied to the grant program. But Councilmember Goble noted that businesses that recently opened are not eligible for the business grants. These businesses have hired employees, but have lost them to other businesses who were able to apply for the grants and received the $5,000. Goble proposed allowing businesses that opened after January 2020 through December 31, 2021, to apply for grant funds for a brief period. A final decision will be made at the council's upcoming goal-setting session. The city also proposed a pilot program to use social workers to help support police officers on calls that don't require use of force. But since the county is about to launch a countywide program, El Cajon opted to postpone action and see how the county program works out. The Downtown El Cajon Business Partners annual report was also presented to the council. A discussion ensued about homelessness, cleaning up city streets, and a need for power washing around homeless camps. Councilmember Goble noted that there's about $350,000 in available funds. He recommended that city staff consider ideas to beautify downtown El Cajon, such as with public art, and make efforts to get people to visit restaurants in El Cajon, especially patrons of Live Nation concerts or other events at the Magnolia Theater. Mayor Wells expressed concern that surplus means the assessment district isn't using the funds for its intended purpose. Wells wants funds used to bring in more businesses or people who are going to do business in El Cajon. Councilmember Gary Kendrick shared that the surplus exists only because so many events had to be canceled in the past year due to COVID. He advised caution in making any commitments based on this unique surplus because those funds might not be available in subsequent years. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
County supervisors will hold a public hearing on January 26th on a proposal to exempt emergency shelters owned, operated, or leased by the county from zoning ordinance provisions. The proposal would also exempt transitional and supportive services. In addition, the project would expand the definition of homeless shelters to include safe parking facilities that are not RV or mobile home parks. It would also include day shelter facilities, safe camping sites, and safe storage facilities for unhoused people. No specific development is currently being proposed by the project, though several sites are under consideration, including Lakeside and Spring Valley sites in East County. The hearing on January 26th will be virtual due to COVID-19 and will begin at 9 a.m. Those wishing to participate or comment should visit the San Diego County Supervisor's website. You can comment by phone during the hearing or send an email to publiccomment@sdcounty.ca.gov. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Elijah McKee.
You are listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea. Public interest news for our region.
California homeowners who have fallen behind on housing payments due to COVID-19 pandemic-related hardships can now apply for help to pay back payments through the California Mortgage Relief Program, which is funded by the 2021 Federal American Rescue Plan Act's Homeowners Assistance Fund. Qualified applicants do not have to repay any funds awarded. The fund has $1 billion in mortgage relief funds that will be provided to California homeowners. The website to get started is camortgagerelief.org. Again, that is camortgagerelief.org. Eligible homeowners for the California Mortgage Relief Program must meet the following criteria. Your household income from all adult household members must be at or below the area median income. There's a calculator at the camortgagerelief.org website to help you determine your eligibility, but the amounts are generous. For instance, a household size of one in San Diego County can earn up to $84,850. For a household of four people, the limit is $121,200. You must own and occupy the home in California as your primary residence and have at least two payments past due by December 27, 2021. You must attest that you experienced a qualified financial hardship due to COVID-19 after January 21, 2020, and describe the nature of the financial hardship. You can't have cash or assets on hand, excluding savings in a retirement account, equal to or greater than the relief funds needed, plus $20,000. For example, homeowners needing $30,000 to get caught up on their mortgage will be ineligible if they have $50,000 or more in assets. The website again to apply for mortgage relief is camortgagerelief.org. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Marie Johnson.
The Lemon Grove Historical Society will celebrate Black History Month with a solo show by famed photographer Mike Norris, February 1st through April 30th on Saturdays from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. at the Parsonage Museum. The exhibition honors the work of a noted African-American photographer whose work is characterized by drama, movement, and deep humanity. While working as a nightclub musician, Norris began doing ride-alongs with a photographer for the Oakland Tribune newspaper. It was sports photography that became Norris's ticket to ride all the way to the Hall of Fame four times with dramatic images of Chargers linebacker Junior Seau, for whom Norris became the personal photographer, and other famous sports stars in baseball, football, and golf. Norris has been named photographer in residence by the Lemon Grove Historical Society, and again, you can view his photos starting February 1st at the Parsonage Museum in Lemon Grove. Reporting for East County Magazine, this is Mitchell Murphy.
K through 12 and higher ed would get $102 billion next fiscal year as part of Governor Gavin Newsom's new budget proposal released Monday, the most in state history thanks to a projected $45 billion surplus. Education advocates say they're glad that the budget would put $200 million toward health care for part-time lecturers who make up 75% of the teaching staff at community colleges. Jeff Freitas is president of CFT, a union of educators and classified professionals.
We want to be able to have individuals that work in multiple districts be able to combine that effort to be able to pay for that health care.
The governor has also proposed $2.7 billion in extra funding to confront COVID-19, so advocates want some of that to be spent on getting more rapid tests and high-quality masks into schools. And the budget includes a 5% cost of living increase for educators, one of the highest ever, which could improve the staffing crisis in our schools. Freitas says the state loses about 27,000 teachers a year, but only about 21,000 new teachers enter the profession annually to replace them.
Pay is a factor, but there's also other factors that weigh into this: class size, responsibility, respect, time to do the job. All of those together are what we need to be focusing on.
The budget proposal also includes funding to offer pre-K classes to all four-year-olds, and it increases the available slots in state-funded preschool and child care centers. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Over 850,000 Americans have died of COVID-19, but many families don't know about a federal program that can pay for funeral expenses such as burial or cremation. The program will pay up to $9,000 per death, or a maximum of $35,000 per application if someone paid for funerals for multiple people. To be eligible, you must be a U.S. citizen, non-citizen national, or qualified alien, and have paid funeral expenses on or after January 20th, 2020, for someone whose death was caused or likely caused by COVID-19. The person must have died in the United States or in a U.S. territory. Applications are taken only by phone, not online. To apply, call the COVID-19 Funeral Assistance Hotline at 844-684-6333, Monday through Friday from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. The program is funded through the Biden administration's Coronavirus Response and Relief Supplemental Appropriations Act and the American Rescue Plan Act. It is administered by the Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA. You can find more information at FEMA.gov, that's FEMA.gov. Then type COVID funeral into the search bar. But you can only apply by telephone by calling 844-684-6333. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Elijah McKee. Over 850,000 Americans have died of COVID-19, but many families don't know about a federal program that can pay for funeral expenses such as burial or cremation. The program will pay up to $9,000 per death, or a maximum of $35,000 per application if someone paid for funerals for multiple people. To be eligible, you must be a U.S. citizen, non-citizen national, or qualified alien, and have paid funeral expenses on or after January 20th, 2020, for someone whose death was caused or likely caused by COVID-19. The person must have died in the United States or in a U.S. territory. Applications are taken only by phone, not online. To apply, call the COVID-19 Funeral Assistance Hotline at 844-684-6333. Monday through Friday from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. The program is funded through the Biden administration's Coronavirus Response and Relief Supplemental Appropriations Act and the American Rescue Plan Act. It is administered by the Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA. You can find more information at FEMA.gov, that's FEMA.gov. Then type COVID funeral into the search bar. But you can only apply by telephone by calling 844-684-6333. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Elijah McKee.
A new report shows California's 13.5 million children are suffering in the wake of the pandemic. It gives the state low marks on child care, foster care, mental health supports, and preventive health screenings. The new 2022 California Children's Report Card from the nonprofit Children Now says children of color in particular are likely to absorb toxic levels of stress. Dr. Harold Goldstein with the group Public Health Advocates notes the suicide rates for teens of color has shot up in the wake of police killings, worsening poverty, and separation from friends during COVID.
The suicide rate among Black young people has doubled in the last 6 years. It is on an upward trajectory. The curve is still going up.
According to the report, only 1 in 4 infants with Medi-Cal coverage got a well baby checkup in 2019, and children's doctor visits have dropped significantly during the pandemic. On the plus side, California gets A grades for getting kids covered by health insurance regardless of immigration status and for putting record funding toward transitional kindergarten for all 4-year-olds. However, Goldstein adds, the state gets low grades for a lack of affordable child care and low rates of pay for caregivers.
If skilled, quality child care isn't available to young people, it's going to impact them for the rest of their lives.
The report authors also conclude that California needs to work harder to find stable homes for foster kids, with nearly 40% being placed in 3 or more homes during a 2-year period. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
The East County Magazine Show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Now stay tuned for part 2 of the East County Magazine radio show.
You are listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea. public interest news for our region.
The East County Magazine Show airs Mondays and Fridays on KNSJ from 5 o'clock to 6 o'clock p.m. You can listen live at 89.1 FM or online at knsj.org. You can also listen anywhere by downloading the TuneIn application for your smartphone. For details, visit tunein.com. Libraries aren't just about books anymore. The San Diego County Library's branches across our region have a variety of events and activities coming up in late January and early February, from book clubs to writers groups to craft classes and Zumba workouts. There are also lunches for seniors, laser tag for teens, and more. You can find a full list of the events at Libraries Countywide at the San Diego County Library website, but here are some highlights. Alpine Library offers drop-in tech help. Thursdays from 10:30 to noon, you can get help downloading the latest magazines, ebooks, and audiobooks for free, as well as get help using the library app on your new phone or tablet. Stop by to receive help from library staff on use of the library's many free and fun digital resources, too. At the Borrego Springs Library, there's a local writers group. They have workshops where you can meet other local writers at the library every Thursday from 12:30 to 3:30 p.m., At each weekly meeting, writers read new material and receive a friendly critique. The Crest Library has one-on-one device help, similar to the Alpine Libraries, on most Thursdays, including January 20th and 27th coming up. You can drop in from 10 to 11 a.m. for help on how to use your smartphone, tablet, or laptop. The Descanso Library offers senior lunches on Wednesdays from noon to 12:30 p.m. Mountain Empire Community Center provides these senior lunches in the parking lot of the library. Orders must be placed in advance. Fletcher Hills Library has Comfy Crafters on the first Thursday of every month at 10 a.m., where you can bring your projects, teach others your craft, and have fun with fellow crafters. The Julian Library has Feeding San Diego distributions of fresh produce and pantry staples in the library parking lot on the second and fourth Wednesdays each month from 9:30 to 11 a.m., weather permitting. Lakeside Library has a book club. The next meeting is January 27th from 4 to 5 p.m. La Mesa Library also offers drop-in tech help Tuesdays from 2 to 3 p.m. The weekly program provides help with specific questions and basic lessons on common applications, and no registration is required. Topics include internet searches, setting up and using email, Microsoft Word, downloading library ebooks, and more. You can join the Lemon Grove Book Club at their library as they discuss the books selected for each particular month. The next meeting is Tuesday, February 8th from 10 a.m. to noon. The meetings take place the second Tuesday of every month at 10 a.m. Poway Library offers basic Zumba fitness classes for adults on Thursdays from 10 a.m. to 11. In the case of inclement weather, this class will be canceled. Ramona Library offers caregiver resources. You can stop by Wednesday, January 26th from 2 to 4 p.m. to get more information about Southern Caregiver Resource Center's free classes for family caregivers caring for a loved one with memory loss, Alzheimer's, or other dementia. The Santee Library has a high school hangout. On Friday, January 21st from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m., youths in grades 9 to 12 can enjoy an exciting night of free laser tag, and there will be similar events in the future. At Spring Valley, teenagers can enjoy painting in the community room on Monday, January 24th from 3:15 to 4. And the Spring Valley Library also has a sewing group where you can bring your own sewing machine and materials every Tuesday from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. to share your love of sewing and create projects. This is Miriam Raftery reporting for East County Magazine.
You are listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea. Public interest news for our region.
A free press is the foundation of our democracy. You can support independent public media for our region. Please support KNSJ by making a donation or a sustaining monthly pledge of any amount at www.knsj.org. We're your community radio station, KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, serving the San Diego border region from the mountains to the sea. That's www.knsj.org. Next up, we have some national news headlines from Public News Service.
The Public News Service Daily Newscast, January the 21st, 2022. I'm Mike Clifford. More than 200 business owners are calling on others to support federal reforms to strengthen election laws.
Senate Democrats were unable to change the filibuster rules on Wednesday night in order to pass legislation to expand voting access across the country. Barry Sick owns Naturepedic, an organic mattress company in Northeast Ohio, and is a member of the American Sustainable Business Network. He says businesses understand a functioning economy relies on a functioning democracy, and that, he says, requires citizen involvement.
If I may be a little bit harsh, we can't just trust government to do the right thing. We need citizen participation. We want a society where everybody's treated equal, everybody has a chance to succeed. Voting rights is one part of that.
The bill defeated in the Senate would have established minimum federal voting standards. It was a response to dozens of bills passed in GOP-controlled states that Democrats argue were designed to make it harder to vote. Mary Sherman reporting.
Meantime, a new wave of Arizona voters in the 2020 election changed the normally conservative state to one where progressive candidates and ideas have a fighting chance. Some are feeling deserted by Senator Kristen Sinema's vote Wednesday night against changing the Senate filibuster.
The move essentially blocked Democrats' efforts to pass new voting rights legislation. Dozens of supporters, including the powerful Emily's List Political Action Committee, say they're reevaluating or outright pulling their support. Roy Tatum, political director of the group Our Voice, Our Vote, says Sinema has left many of her supporters scratching their heads.
We feel that she's abandoned those of us who supported her. I've had a number of conversations with her directly around some of the specific issues that we were dealing with, and I had no idea that she would just be so distant.
Sinema says while she supports the Freedom to Vote Act and the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, she refuses to modify the filibuster in order to pass them with a simple majority. Sinema's election to the Senate, along with fellow Democrat Mark Kelly, was hailed as proof that conservatives had lost their tight grip on Arizona politics. I'm Mark Richardson.
And from the Hill, the U.S. Supreme Court Thursday rebuffed abortion providers' latest legal maneuver in their challenge to the Texas six-week ban, which has sharply reduced abortion access in the state since taking effect nearly 5 months ago. The order issued without comment was unsigned but appeared to divide the court along ideological lines, with the court's three liberal justices writing in dissent. The Hill notes an issue as a procedural fight over which tier of the lower federal courts the case should return to after a divided Supreme Court ruled last month that abortion providers could contest the ban in federal court and list Texas state licensing officials as defendants. This is PNS. And if the state of Iowa wants to create a healthier outcome for its residents, advocates say there are steps policymakers can take right now to make it happen.
As the legislative session takes shape, there are calls to extend postpartum health coverage for new mothers under Medicaid, which in Iowa ends after 60 days. But the federal government is now giving states the option to extend the coverage to 12 months. The American Heart Association's Stacy Freeland says that would make a big preventative health difference.
If you think about heart disease and stroke and how many mothers are impacted, mothers and babies.
Supporters say this type of expansion would help reduce racial disparities in maternal health. At the same time, groups like the Heart Association worry about proposals to add requirements for people receiving public assistance. Bill sponsors say they're needed to improve management of the programs and avoid federal fines, but critics say they'll hurt access. Health priorities are the topic in a virtual day of action on January 26th. I'm Mike Mullen.
Right now, only 6% of Iowa kids under age 3 who qualify have access to Head Start. Healthcare workers at an Oregon hospital have achieved what they say is a win after several strikes in recent months. More on that from Eric Tiganoff.
Nearly 300 workers and members of Service Employees International Union Local 49 at McKenzie Willamette Medical Center in Springfield are celebrating increases in their pay, their health subsidies, and education fund. SEIU Local 49 members went on strike in October and December, including Aaron Gordon, a certified nursing assistant at the hospital.
It took a lot for us to go out twice, but it gave management the push to understand where we're coming from and to see we're out here to support our community, and our community came out to support us, and that helped get the message through to them.
The workers represent a wide array of professions, including emergency room technicians, physical therapists, and social workers.
Finally, we learn from our Lily Bulkey, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers plans to use federal funds for a project to keep invasive carp out of the Great Lakes.
It's proposing nearly $226 million from the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act for the Brandon Road Lock and Dam Project in Joliet. Don Jodry with the Alliance for the Great Lakes says the carp crowd out native aquatic species and have been moving up the Mississippi River and into the Illinois River. He says the project would modify the existing dam and locks to make it easier to prevent invasive species from passing through.
The Great Lakes have suffered over the years from invasive aquatic species like zebra and quagga mussels and things like this. And so the concern is if the carp move into the Great Lakes system, that they're going to be detrimental to the fishing and recreational industries that are up there.
This is Mike Clifford, and thank you for wrapping up your week with Public News Service. Member and listener supported. We're heard on interesting radio stations. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
Next up, we're going to replay one of our Best of East County episodes, and I hope you're going to enjoy this as much as we did.
This is Helen Ofield from the Lemon Grove Historical Society, bringing you the sounds of history.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ, and today I am guest hosting our Sounds of History segment, bringing you another colorful story from East County's past. I have a special guest today. His name is Larry McKim, and Larry was a firefighter for many years with the El Cajon Fire Department. He's the historian for the fire department, and he's here to tell us about his own role in a very daring rescue at the old El Cajon Jail, which was not exactly Alcatraz. You're going to hear why. Welcome to the show, Larry.
Oh, good morning. Thanks. Thanks for having us.
So you were on duty the morning of August 24th, 1984.
Yes.
Tell us about the call that came in.
Well, we were out at the training facility, at Heartland Training Facility on North Marshall, and about an hour into the drill, we heard the radio come across as someone breaking out of the county jail there.
Which was a 10-story building about 200 feet high where the El Cajon Courthouse is now. It used to be the top three floors up there with the jail.
Correct. So the chief had sent the ambulance code 3 to pick me up at the training facility and bring me back code 3
Why you?
Why, I'd gone to the heavy rescue school at Port Hueneme, and so I'd been trained to do heavy rescues and to perform rappelling and to teach our guys how to do the rappelling in case something like this ever occurred, not knowing that it would ever happen. But sure enough, on August 24th, it happened.
So you got to the scene, and what did you find?
When we got to the scene, we had heard by that time that somebody had fallen to his death, and the other person was still dangling from a rope on the third bottom ledge that you can see from the east side of the building.
Yeah, and these were young kids. They were a couple of 18-year-olds. The one who died, tragically, was in for burglary, and the other fellow that you were sent to rescue had been in there for a parole violation.
Correct.
18 years old.
Yes.
Okay, so you get up on top of the building, and what did your chief say to you?
Well, Chief Stray told me to go up there and take care of the rescue, and then Captain Mike Thompson at the time, he said, you tie everything off. If you die, it's going to be your own fault, so nobody else is going to take responsibility.
Great, very encouraging words.
Yeah.
Okay, so I jump tied off this building with these.
So I'm up there with my crew, and we started tying everything off, and then I got ready to go over the ledge, and a big guy named Jim Lockwood had a hold of me, and Jim said, I've got you, and I won't let you go. So I said, okay, if you're ready, I'm ready. So he finally let me loose over the edge, and I rappelled down, and went down and then pulled up about 6-8 feet to the side of this young man and then told him, you know.
Who was trapped on a ledge, right?
Trapped on a ledge.
Saw his buddy, you know, didn't make it and decided this is far enough, or he just couldn't get down.
He couldn't get down that far as he could go.
Now, what had happened? I understand they had kicked through the wall of the cell and they had
kicked the hole through the wall and then had tied mattress covers and stripped it down and tied into a long rope, basically. If you know anything about knots, time, distance, and weight on an overhand knot will pull through. And that's exactly what happened.
Okay, so he was really trapped. He was stuck up there.
Yep, he's stuck on that ledge, just hanging onto it. And the ledge is about 9 inches long, and it sloped on a little bit of an angle so that the water will run off it.
Mm-hmm.
But he just sat there and laid there until I pulled up alongside him.
So what were you thinking when you went over the edge?
I was pretty nervous going over the edge, actually.
How long was your rope?
My rope was 200 foot long, but you figure it tied off some of it and 186 foot down to the ground.
That left you 14 feet to go when you got to the bottom.
Correct. But with Kern Mantle rope, you have a 10% stretch. So
you're pretty close.
We were pretty close at the end of the when we got down to the ground after the rescue was over with, we were at the end of the rope.
So when you got down there and you found this guy on the ledge, what did you say to him or what did he say to you?
Well, when I got up alongside him at the edge, I told him, I said, don't touch me or any of my equipment, or you might have a long way to go down to the ground, because your life didn't mean anything to me at the time. I was, you know, pretty nervous and figured he's a prisoner, so.
Yeah. How did you get him down?
Well, I tied a pompier belt that we used to carry on our ladder trucks to keep you secured in the basket. I tied that onto him, which I immediately hooked onto me, so I knew he couldn't fall. He may be upside down if I didn't get the other safety line on him. But in the meantime, at least he was secure to me. Then I had another rope sent down from the top and then tied that on him. It's called a bullet on a coil, which we no longer use that anymore either. Just, you know, 30 years ago training, and that's what we knew and that's what we did. So today they have rescue harnesses and class one harnesses to tie and secure to people. It makes it safer.
Very good. So how long did it take to finally reach
I want to say it was like 45 minutes, but it just seemed like it was seconds and minutes, you know, when I was doing the rescue. It just went by so quickly. It was interesting to, you know, to get down to the ground with him and then finally touch the earth.
Yeah. Now, you received a lot of commendations for your bravery, I understand.
Yes, former Mayor John Reber gave me Class C commendation from the city. Mm-hmm. My captain wrote a nice letter on me. Former Congressman Jay LeSueur, who was a lieutenant at the jail at the time, and he was in charge of the detention center. He gave me a letter. I got a letter from one of the judges there in the courthouse.
Right, and we've seen all of these. You brought in that wonderful album you have as the historian for the fire department. So after the jailbreak incident, they did make some efforts to make it more secure. They strengthened up some of the things there, but some of the windows and things. But it didn't work so well.
No, I had a couple more jailbreaks after that, so.
They did. Let's see, there was one guy that managed to get all the way out, and he was found hiding in the restroom of the courthouse. That wasn't real safe. There was another guy who got out for a whole month to go visit his dying father, and they found him a month later in a brothel and brought him back, and he was apparently the hero of the jailhouse because he actually got away with it. And then there were seven more who broke out, and as of the old newspaper articles I found, I don't think all of them were ever found. Do you know?
I have no idea if they've been caught yet or today or not.
Yeah. Those guys had tied 30 bed sheets together to make their big escape. And the walls, apparently, some of them were made of styrofoam or some kind of foam material that was so lightweight they could kick it out.
Correct.
Apparently, they said the walls were more secure at the local dog pound than at the jail.
Yes, because it's made of blocks, so nobody's going to be kicking a hole through that.
Yeah. County Supervisor George Bailey at the time called it a multi-million dollar turkey and said it was the least secure jail, you know, who knows, maybe anywhere, certainly in San Diego County.
Without a doubt, it had to be the least secure jail in the history of mankind.
Finally, in the 90s, they just gave up the ghost on it, and it did close down. It's not there anymore. Now it's just a courthouse building.
Correct.
Larry, thank you very much for joining us here today.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, bringing us another colorful tale from East County's past here on the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ.
You are listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea. Public interest news for our region.
By next fall, refugee students may be able to apply to attend American colleges and universities. The State Department says it plans to pilot a new category for refugee admissions called a P4. P4 status would allow a group or institution to sponsor a refugee, and a university sponsorship program would allow that person to study in the U.S. and then apply for permanent residency. Laura Wagner is with the Initiative on U.S. Education Pathways for Refugee Students, part of the President's Alliance on Higher Education and Immigration. Wagner says the current foreign student visa program requires students to leave after they graduate.
Right now, we are getting the best and the brightest of the world, and then we're saying, thanks, now you have to go back to your home country, whereas this would provide an opportunity for them to stay and continue to use and share those talents with their new community in the U.S.
The Alliance recently published a report calling on the State Department to implement a P4 category this spring. Community colleges and universities, including UC Davis, would step up to offer free tuition. Philanthropic groups would cover other costs, and the State Department would aid in resettlement. Wagner says refugees deserve a shot at a brighter future in the U.S., a country founded by immigrants.
Less than 1% of refugees worldwide are able to be resettled. We have only 5% of refugees accessing higher ed.
Advocates of the pilot program say it could initially be limited to 30 students who would apply next fall and start their college classes in 2024. Support for this reporting was provided by Lumina Foundation. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
This is Connie Beck with Ready, Set, Grow. I'm going to help you create healthy and beautiful gardens using less money, less hard work, and much more fun. I'd like to talk today about some plants you can plant to bring in hummingbirds. Everybody loves them. Nobody wants to fill those feeders. They get ants in them. They get bees in them. They get mold in them. And someday I'll convince my husband to quit putting sugar water in them and feeding them, because there's enough in my yard to keep every hummingbird in East County quite happy for quite a while. So what do you want to put in your yard that will bring in the hummingbirds? My favorite plant is a cultivar of a native plant. It is called Galvezia firecracker. If you go to most nurseries nowadays, this plant has become so popular that you can get it. Just ask for firecracker, which is different than Russellia. It's a Galvezia, G-A-L-V-E-Z-I-A. This is a plant that gets to be about 4 feet tall, 4 feet wide, and it has red tubular flowers. And that's the key, isn't it? Red tubular flowers. That's what brings in the hummingbirds. They love it. Can't stay away from them. This is a much more manageable and nice plant than the Cape honeysuckle with the big orange flowers and the plant that gets to be 15 feet tall and 20 feet wide and goes everywhere and is a big floppy mess. Try a firecracker and see what you think. You can grow it in the sun, in the shade, in part sun, in part shade, with a lot of water or with just a little bit of water, and it will be fine. I have a neighbor who grows it under pepper trees, and the gardeners come every week and prune them into little round balls, and they never really get to bloom, and those trees have suffered through that for the last few years without a single one of them dying. Now that's what I would call an obliging plant. Another good plant that will bring in lots and lots of wildlife to your garden, and hummingbirds especially, is called California fuchsia. It's called Epilobium. Some of you may have known it in the past as Zauschneria. What a great name. So there's a good password for you. Zauschneria. Who's going to use a word like that for their password? Zauschnerias, or Epilobiums, California fuchsia, are a gray plant, and they have a bright orange-red tubular flower. Once again, great for hummingbirds, really keeps them happy. This is a plant that will actually spread slightly on its own and will get by even if something bad happens to the irrigation and nobody irrigates it for 6 weeks or 6 months. It won't die. It'll be fine. Anytime you go to a nursery, look around and look for the plants that have the red tubular flowers. That's the key to hummingbirds. Now, my friend Maureen Austin, who puts on the Sage and Songbirds Festival every year, says there's two kinds of wildlife-attracting plants out there. There's ice cream cones, which we're talking about now. These are the tubular-shaped flowers that the hummingbirds like. Or there's pizzas, and pizzas are the flat flowers, the daisy-type flowers, that you see butterflies landing on. If you think about butterfly bush, Buddleia, which brings in all sorts of cute little butterflies, it also is fragrant. It's known as summer lilac here, or butterfly bush. Then if you take a close look at those purple spikes that grow on that bring in the butterflies, you'll see a whole bunch of little bitty flowers. And that's what the butterflies are landing on. That's what they like. So that's a great one. Probably the best butterfly plant that you can come up with, though, is always going to be the butterfly weed, milkweed, Asclepias curassavica. It has orange and red flowers on it, and it just grows like a weed in your garden. Not invasive, just reseeds very effectively. You will know that you have succeeded when you see interesting looking green caterpillars all over the plant, eating every leaf. In my garden, I pick them off and I move them to another milkweed after they eat all the leaves off one. I don't try to fight them because they're going to turn into monarch butterflies. So my garden is full of monarch butterflies, which I consider to be flying flowers. So keep in mind, butterfly milkweed is a great plant to add to your garden repertoire.
A free press is the foundation of our democracy. You can support independent public media for our region. Please support KNSJ by making a donation or a sustaining monthly pledge of any amount at www.knsj.org. We're your community radio station, KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, serving the San Diego border region from the mountains to the sea. That's www.knsj.org. This concludes today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, A.K. Jewel, Brian Boyko, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road, Blues 3 Music, and Pond 5. If you would like to underwrite or sponsor the East County Magazine radio show, or get involved as a volunteer on our public interest news show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We'll be back soon with another edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show. The East County Magazine Show airs Mondays and Fridays on KNSJ from 5 o'clock to 6 o'clock p.m. You can listen live at 89.1 FM or online at knsj.org. You can also listen anywhere by downloading the TuneIn application for your smartphone. For details, visit tunein.com.